Welcome to the Kings of Sport, the program that's changing the game one show at a time. With your hosts, Nate Milton.
Yes! That boy's good.
And Marcus Vandenberg.
Let's say!
So sit back and relax, because you're now down with the Kings.
You guys not allowed. Nah, I'm just kidding.
What time is it?
My mentality was to go out and win at any cost.
Jordan is the most talented player in the NBA by far.
The show of the 90s, the team of the 90s.
How you doing?
Whenever they speak Michael Jordan, they should speak Scottie Pippen.
We created an image that people want to live up to. I think that's all you can hope for.
To the Kings of Sport, the program changing the game one show at a time, aka the world's most dangerous sportscast, aka iTunes' longest running weekly episodic program produced and hosted by two or more African Americans who are not affiliated with a major network. I'm your host, the Godfather Nate Milton. We are here, people. We made it to the end. We are in the end game now. To quote that man, Dr. Strange, we are at the conclusion of our series covering the great ESPN documentary The Last Dance, and I can't do it alone, fellas. I can't do it alone, ladies. I can't do it alone, people. And so I gotta bring in my co-host, my tag team partner, the Scottie Pippen to my Michael Jordan, the Horace Grant to my Beach Day Armstrong. Ladies and gentlemen, from Southern California, give it up for Marcus. Yeah, I'm listening to Kenny Lattimore. It's new. It's not even out yet. You ain't know he was a friend of mine? Vandenberg, what's good, brother?
What kind of maniac listens to Kenny Lattimore to get pumped up?
Yo, and Mike was into it too. Like, really. Like this how we going off on Kenny Lattimore.
I'm glad Kenny responded, though. Did you see his tweet?
No, what did the great R&B singer Kenny Lattimore say?
He basically confirmed that Michael had that exclusive.
Yo, the craziest thing is, again, like, I got to give all the credit in the world to Jalen Rose and David Kobe in the after show with Jason Ayer, because they're like, they didn't know the exact song that Mike was listening to. So they pieced together, like, the production crew. They're like, okay, this is 98. What Kenny Lattimore record came out in 98? Let's look at the way Michael is bobbing his head. Let's go back, time the beats per minute. See, and wow. They found the exact Kenny Lattimore song that he was listening to.
That's
crazy.
Have you seen the parody account on Twitter?
No.
It's at Jordan Jamming, and someone is just dubbing songs over that video of Michael listening to Kayla. It's pretty funny.
Oh, man. Like, I think if anything else, Marcus, before we get into the actual episodes themselves, like, Michael Jordan, yes, he is the greatest of all time in basketball, but after this documentary, Marcus, Mike might be the go to memes as well.
Yes.
Whether it's the iTunes, you know, looking at the iPad and laughing, or you know, giving a side eye, or you know, the headphone one has become a big one this week. I think my favorite one somebody did is like they took a screenshot at a moment where Mike takes off the headsets to answer the question from the guy that was filming, and the caption they put on it was Scott Burrell breathes, and then Michael Jordan just looking at him like, I'm like, yo, they going too far with this, man.
Yeah, I mean, if you count crying MJ, that's a meme. He's already sort of, you know, he's already set the bar as probably the most memeable athlete on Twitter. Mm-hmm. And now with The Last Dance, I mean, it's over. It's a wrap.
Yeah, like there's at least three top 10 memes that came out of this. Out of the documentary.
Yeah, and if you count the security guard with the shrug, I mean, that's...
Yep.
So, yeah, it's all over, guys.
It's all over, but, yeah, what a gift, Marcus Vandenberg. What a gift that Jason Ayer and his crew and Michael Jeffrey Jordan have given to the world when they needed it the most.
And actually, it was a pretty fast 5 weeks, right? Like, this went by pretty fast.
Yeah. And it's funny because I think one thing that people have noticed kind of during this pandemic, during this time of crisis, is we don't actually notice, like, how much time actually passes during the week. But when you're, like, stuck at home, or when you can only work a couple days a week, or when you have to stay inside, that passage of time gets so elongated, right? Gets drug out. But like you said, every Monday, like clockwork, MJ was there. Yeah. And just through watching this thing, yeah, it doesn't seem like it's been 5 weeks, right? And so, like, that's a gift in and of itself that this documentary gave people in these uncertain times, as the ads say.
Yeah, and in general, I mean, I think time is just moving a lot. I mean, considering Memorial Day, and that's Monday already.
Mm.
It feels like March was, you know, 6 months ago, but in reality, it was less than 2 months ago. So,
yeah,
I mean, it looks like, at least from our end in California, the new date they're aiming for is July 4th, and it sounds like July 4th will be the end of the restrictions in terms of economic, so like shopping and all that stuff can reopen. So I'm sure Virginia will probably beat us to that date, just because of the population and everything and the number of cases. But it feels like we're moving from this transition to trying to avoid COVID-19 to now trying to live with COVID-19.
Yeah, like in terms of Virginia, like the date that the governor has projected and is targeting is June, like beginning of June. So, like we're getting close. So I think this past week was when barbershops finally opened on a like limited basis. You know, they can only see one or two clients at a time, and everybody else has to wait outside 6 feet apart from each other. Like, you know, I went and voted on Tuesday. They had pushed the election back a couple weeks, and so I went and voted, and they made sure people were distant from each other, and you had to be wearing a mask at the polls. And so, yeah, I think we're slowly but surely, as a country, in spite of our inept leadership, Marcus, we're kind of getting to a place where, yeah, we're not going to stay inside. We're not going to stay sequestered in quarantine forever, but we're also not going to be stupid and rush back like nothing happened. And so, like, you know, when you talk about people like your man Newsom or Governor Northam out here in Virginia, or the governor of Ohio, who was doing good things before Trump got in his ear. Like, I think the governors are going to be the ones, you know, Cuomo, are going to be the ones that actually lead us through this, rather than your man who is up here talking about taking medicine that he ain't even really taking.
Yeah, I mean, either he's a liar and he's not taking it, or he's taking it and he's a moron. So either way, it's a bad, it's a bad right. outcome. But yeah, you know, to the point of reopening, it is like, I respect people who don't want to go out in all this, but I also respect people who sort of want to, you know, work and
yeah,
provide for their family. So it's going to be, hopefully, you know, for us out here, you got to wear a mask when you go out. That's not for every state, but at least for LA proper, that will be sort of the norm for the foreseeable future. And that's fine. You know, if you don't want to wear the mask, stay home. Like, that is pretty simple.
Right. Yeah. And so, yeah, I would hope that, like, we are smart enough to do the right things now, so that whenever the inevitable bounce back comes, you know, that they keep talking about in the fall, that we're better prepared for that than we were this time around.
Yeah.
So, and speaking of being prepared and living in the moment, Marcus Vandenberg, let's talk about episodes 9 and 10 of The Last Dance, people. That's what we've been doing this whole month. We've been reviewing the documentary, giving you our takes on the episodes that we watched. And not only are Marcus and I going to give you our takes this week, but a little bit later we'll be joined by a special guest. I'm going to tell the joke now so I don't have to tell it when he comes on. But, you know, every time Mike won a championship, there was a certain type of person that helped him win, right,
Mark? No. Oh, no.
Whether it was a John Paxson or a Judd Bushler or that man Steve Kerr, there was always that type of individual that had a high motor and was a hard worker and was scrappy and a gym rat that brought that winning shot for Michael Jordan. That's what we got today. We're going to bring in a hard-working, scrappy podcaster with a high motor, friend of the program from Post Wrestling, John Pollock, to come in and hit that game-winning shot for us.
What do all those people have in common, Nate?
That they're professionals, Marcus. Oh, yes. Yeah, we're going to bring in our brother John Pollock. He's going to give his thoughts on this documentary from a Canadian's point of view. But real quick, Marcus, let's kind of some big points on episode 9 and 10 of the documentary. We kind of took a different tack, and I wasn't prepared for this, but after listening to the after show with Jason Ayer, it makes a lot of sense that we got in 9 and 10 more game footage than we probably have throughout the rest of the documentary combined.
Yeah, and considering that both the last two finals were Utah, they sort of blended together in terms of, mm-hmm. you know, 97 and 98. But, yeah, there was a lot of footage from both of those Utah series, the Indiana series that led to, was it the 98 finals to beat Indiana?
Because they had to go to on the road for that first game in Utah.
Yes. So, yeah, there was a lot of footage, and, you know, it was actually, before we dive into it, what did you sort of think about the last two episodes compared to the first eight?
I like the first eight more.
Yeah.
Just because it was stuff that, A, I hadn't seen as opposed to these games, and B, I think we got more, you know, kind of behind the scenes stories than we did in 9 and 10. But, I mean, I still enjoyed 9 and 10, just not as much as the previous 8.
Yeah, it wasn't... 9 and 10 weren't my favorite episodes in the group, but they weren't bad. They were just, you know, I think I was expecting sort of like this crescendo ending. Mm. And here's
another thing, Marcus, and I'm glad that Jason Ayer has spoken about this past week, because this documentary is weird, right? Because it's focusing on this one season and this one team. But let's be real. Everybody, and you know, everybody's like, it's the Michael Jordan documentary.
Mm-hmm.
right? Like even people that aren't sports fans. Like I was doing the Black Lightning podcast this past weekend, and Vanessa, one of the co-hosts, she was like, "What time are we going to be finished? Because that Michael Jordan show is coming on tonight." And so it's like people like it's a Michael Jordan documentary, but it wasn't a Michael Jordan documentary in the fact that we didn't get Juanita, right? We didn't get a lot of the kids. We didn't we didn't get the Wizards stuff. We didn't get the Hornets stuff. We didn't get the Hall of Fame. And so, like, there's things that I wanted from the documentary that, in retrospect, aren't the fault of the documentary because that's not what it was set out to be. Mm-hmm. But by the same token, like, I think halfway through, or maybe even before, you know, maybe even from episode one, it morphed from being this documentary focused on this one team and this one season to this is the Michael Jordan documentary.
Yeah, and I do wonder if, well, I don't know. I was going to say it feels like you could do another three episodes, but I'm not sure if Jordan wants to dive into his post-Bulls career.
Why are you such a bad evaluator of talent, Mike?
Yeah, I mean, if you're...
Why are you out here giving contracts to Kwame Brown and Nicholas Batum?
Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen.
And so many Zellers. Like, didn't at one point Charlotte have both Zellers?
Then they had Tyler and they Cody. Had Cody.
Yep, they had both Zellers and I think a couple Plumleys or one of the Plumleys.
Plums and the Zellers, man.
Like, what are you doing, MJ?
Yeah, I mean, you can't be perfect. maybe, you know, that's been humbling for him to fail year in and year out as an owner. Like, that's knowing now what we've seen in this documentary in terms of how he's wired, like, that has to be really hard for him, knowing that he, while he's in charge, there's only so much he can control. And maybe that's why he ends up, you know, slapping players on the bench. Like, he's just, who did he slap? That was it wasn't Malik Monk, was it?
I remember the story. I can't remember the player. But, like, yeah. Like, what are we doing, Mike?
Let's see. Jordan slapping.
And I think part of it is that he is...
Like, yeah, Malik Monk.
Malik Monk. Okay. Like, we saw in the documentary, like, Michael's not the type of person that is, like, outgoing and makes friends easily. Mm-hmm. But when you're Michael's friend, when you make it into that inner circle, you in for life.
Yeah.
Whether you talk about you know, Gus, the security guard who passed away, or the other guy that was a cab driver that became like his best friend.
Yeah, he has loyalty to
George,
everyday common people. Which
yeah, and so I think like in his position as a part owner and making these personnel decisions, he's probably too loyal to his connections that he has and friends that he has, whether that be scouts or people in the college collegiate ranks, like. Because he's never been a good evaluator of talent. Like, going all the way back to Kwame Brown and the Wizards.
Yeah, that's when we sort of first knew that. maybe this isn't it for you, Mike. And then, you know, to be responsible for drafting Kwame and then having to play with Kwame, which was an interesting dynamic there, too.
Yeah.
The Hornets. I am surprised that, and maybe there was a little bit in Washington when he came back, but just having Jordan attached to a team never made a team popular or more popular than it should have been. Like, and I think the Wizards run, you definitely saw a lot more Wizards merchandise during that time. But
yeah, I think the Wizards, it was like this perfect storm because for those that don't remember Jordan as a Washington Wizard, like, it coincided with the aftermath of 9/11.
That's right.
So there was a lot of good feelings for, you know, D.C. in general. And then you bring the biggest sports star in the world and put him on that team. And they were actually decent, right? Like, a lot of people try to play Mike, you know, when they joke about his time with the Wizards. But Mike was actually decent on the Wizards.
Yeah, I mean, Mike was definitely better than Kobe at that age. Not even close. You know, Mike was 38, 39 those last two seasons.
He still averaged 20-something points.
Yeah, over 20 points. And towards the end, he came off the bench. He was becoming more of a sits man, which I'm sure was...
Yeah, you know, yeah, that was crazy inside, that, yeah, that period where we had Michael Jordan leading the second unit.
Yeah, but listen, he... I think he knew that I can't hang with... the first crew, and I'm not going to be here after the next season. So
I can't hang with Rip Hamilton out here on these streets.
Yeah.
But yeah, like I think for me, Marcus, when you look at 9 and 10, outside of like, because I really enjoyed like maybe the last, I want to say 10 minutes where they do like the from the Bulls winning the championship and having the celebration in Chicago to. Talking about like the dismantling of the Bulls, I enjoyed that section. But before we get to that, I think the thing that stood out to a lot of people was the pizza incident, man.
Yes,
AKA the flu game.
Yeah, so this was episode 9, the infamous flu game, which was in 1997 in Salt Lake City, and you know the story had always been that. Well, there's two stories. One that Jordan. Ended up getting a flu before Game 5. The other story was Jordan was hungover before Game 5. Jordan says it's neither. He had a stomach flu. He ordered this pizza late at night in Park City. The pizza arrives with like 5 other people that are trying to sort of take a peek at who's in the room. And Jordan didn't share the pizza. He ate the whole pizza himself. Despite having other people in the room, selfish.
I got a little tidbit on that. I'm gonna wait till we have John on to share that tidbit because it made so much sense and it's so Michael Jordan. But go ahead.
Yeah. So that was like around 10 o'clock, and he said by 2:30 in the morning he was up, thrown up, and you know couldn't move, and you know had to call the team doctor, and the doctor came in and. Got him on IVs and all that stuff. And, you know, the next day was Game 5. And, of course, you know how that worked out for the Bulls when Jordan somehow willed himself to a W. But I don't know. I mean, I feel comfortable ruling out the flu because it feels like why would you lie about, you know, having the flu? So it's either the stomach flu or it's this other story that came up today, again this week, where Jordan was allegedly in Las Vegas and he was gambling and, you know, came back hungover. I'm gonna call bullshit on that story because I feel like at that point in his life, Jordan has done enough drinking to the point where he's not going to be hungover. Like, his body can sort of consume and
yeah.
He's used to drinking that brown liquor. So, I'm leaning towards...
Not to shade the GOAT, Marcus, but this is something I noticed throughout this whole documentary, particularly these last two episodes where we got these really intense, dramatic close-ups of MJ. Them eyes, brother.
Yeah.
He got them drinker's eyes, man.
He does.
Got that little tinge to it.
He does. Since the very beginning of this documentary, it was...
Yeah.
So, I'm gonna say he legit had the, you know, the stomach flu.
Yeah, that's an interesting story. Like, because again, that game is something that is part of why Jordan is so great, right? Part of why the legacy and the legend of Michael Jordan is so big, and to find out that it. Might either be a hangover to some people or it's a nefarious plot by these people and you talk to my by this band of brothers, this 5 guys pizza delivery. It's crazy. And again, I got a great story, a great addition to that story to tell you about later. But I think that for our contingency in our group, and we can talk about it here in a second with John Pollock, maybe other than Mike and Gus, the person that stood out the most to me in these episodes was the New World Order's own Dennis Rodman.
Yes, they finally touched on Rodman's wrestling career, which really took off during the finals, during an off day where he flew. I forgot where Nitro was that night, but he left Utah, did Nitro, missed practice, and then came back for the finals game. And I mean, listen, if that happened today, and especially if it was because of wrestling,
could
you imagine the reaction?
The outrage.
Oh, my God.
Skip Bayless would lose his damn mind.
Yeah. But you got to remember, at the time in 97 or 98? This was 97, I believe. Wrestling was a lot more popular than it was now. So I think there was, I don't see people forgave Dennis for what he did, but I think people understood what he was doing.
Right. You know, it's great that you bring up Dennis Rodman, Marcus, and, you know, you bring up the Worm and how wrestling kind of ties into this, because we're going to bring in one of our favorite people, one of the, you know, he's not just a friend of the program. He's damn near family, ladies and gentlemen. He's our John Paxson. He's our Steve Kerr. Ladies and gentlemen, from Post Wrestling, one half of the great team of Pollock and Ting, John Pollock is joining us. Brother Pollock, how you doing, man?
I am here. I am happy to be the Steve Kerr or Bill Paxson, whichever white member of the Bulls you want to assign to me.
Wow, John, I was trying to protect you from this early before you jumped on.
John, I was picking clutch players. That's where I was going with that.
Oh, is that key. Here I am coming in the clutch with you guys. So happy to discuss my ability to, in my opinion, the best 8 minutes of either of episode 9 or 10 has to be Steve Kerr. Can we all be in agreement on that one? I thought that was like among the strongest chapters of this entire
good timing, because we haven't taught Steve Kerr yet.
Yeah, well, I guess, John, that leads me to my first question I was going to have for you, because obviously anybody that's listened to Post Wrestling knows how big a fan you were of the Raptors back in the day. Were you just a Raptors fan or an NBA fan in general? And so going back and watching this, like, how did this connect and resonate?
So I was not like a huge basketball fan until the Raptors started. So that would have been the in 95 when the expansion team began. So that was just kind of my entryway into having a reason to go. Like, I was all about Major League Baseball at the time. That was my big sport, and maybe hockey second. And basketball was kind of just I didn't have that connection through a team to root for. So when the Raptors began like having all of their games televised, I just dove right into it, and basketball quickly shot up to number one. So that would be about, I would say my fandom was at its peak from 95 till I would say the 2001 season, where the Raptors lose there with that just that jaw-dropping, very, very sad loss in the playoffs in 2001. That was kind of my peak period. So, I mean, a huge amount of that more so centers around the final three championships from the Bulls rather than the first three. But I will put my memory of the Raptors being one of the only teams to be able to credit that we beat the Bulls that year. That to me is one of the most memorable games I had ever watched. And the Raptors winning that, I treated that like we had won the NBA championship. I didn't need any playoff berth for the Raptors. We beat the Bulls once, and that's it. It was going up to the biggest bully in the school, landing a punch, and then getting the hell out of there before they could retaliate. It was like, we landed it. We landed one clean shot on the Bulls that year. We'll take it. It was like the greatest moment ever that season.
John was like BJ Armstrong when he hit that shot.
Was that at the Sky Dome, John?
That was at the Sky Dome. This predated the Air Canada Center, which didn't open up until 1999. I went to a few games at the Sky Dome, and it was just an awful venue to watch basketball in. Like, they would have the like the makeshift bleachers set up on the floor. So if you watch on TV, it's not that cavernous, but they would also open up like the regular like 100 level seats for that are like, this is designed for baseball, this stadium, and you'd sit there and it's just empty seats everywhere minus the bleachers that you would see on television. But it was just a terrible place to play basketball, and it kind of tells you, it was kind of apropos for the Raptors team, which was very much not front and center in the Toronto sports landscape. And it was, here you go, have fun with the 60,000 seat Skydome to figure out a fan base for this team, which, I mean, when you look at it now, like night and day compared to where the fandom was for the Raptors then versus now.
Yes. So you mentioned.
So what did you make? I was going to say, Marcus, talking about Steve Kerr, because yes. John, for the folks that don't know, you know, John had worked on a fantastic documentary before. So when you look at what Jason Ayer did, and Marcus and I were speaking earlier, that this documentary had the task of trying to balance the story of this team, of this 98 Bulls squad, but also knowing that everybody's coming here for Michael Jordan. Mm-hmm. And so you've got to focus on Jordan, but you've also got to talk about Tony Kukoc. You've also got to talk about Scottie Pippen. You've also got to talk about Dennis Rodman. And in episode 9, you've also got to talk about Steve Kerr. And this great kind of, well, not great, great is the wrong word, but this kind of really compelling and humanizing and tragic story of what Steve Kerr and his family went through, and juxtaposing that with him hitting these big shots. So as a filmmaker, how did that hit you? And then also, you know, looking at Steve Kerr, who I think maybe a lot of the kids watching, a lot of the younger folks have no clue about this guy or his history beyond the fact that he won championships with the Golden State Warriors as their coach.
Yeah, I would think for a lot of people that are tuning into this, that's the go-to connection of Steve Kerr. But to me, he was someone that, you know, was just a staple of this Bulls team, but never to me like the front and center guy. That was just not his role. He was not even number two or number three. But kind of his involvement in this series is kind of, you know, very much resembling what his role was on the team. Like, here was a guy that was going to get a small amount of time, but to me it was among the most impactful. Like, that 8 minutes to me was just like fantastic storytelling of going from, you know, we had already had the story earlier in the series about the whole dust up with Jordan and kind of gaining this guy's respect. But then you go into this backstory with him. And I mean, I wasn't even that aware of the circumstances behind his father's death. So I was kind of watching that with fresh eyes. But to go from Steve Kerr talking about how he would play in his father's memory and thinking of his father whenever the national anthem would play, and then they cut to the court where you're hearing the anthem. I mean, maybe that was an obvious edit point, but I thought it was done in a really nice fashion that kind of took us from this really heavy story back into the game scenario with this very unique bridge of the national anthem as well. I just thought that part was fantastic. It was among my favorites of the whole 10 episodes.
And it was also this link between Jordan and Kerr, who both had fathers who were murdered. And I'm sure that was something that they eventually bonded over during their time in Chicago. But, you know, when you look at Steve Kerr now in 2020, and it's Deuce Asher in the background, he's crying. when you
shout out the young baby Simba.
When you see Steve Kerr now, who is so outspoken, especially when it comes to anything gun control related, it all kind of makes sense of knowing Steve's background and what he's been through, that why he's so outspoken and political.
Yeah, and I mean, that would also be, I guess, you know, when it comes to Michael Jordan as well. I mean, he has had these issues in his life, but someone that, you know, going into this documentary, I think a lot of people wanted to get beneath that surface with Jordan, who's been so apolitical throughout his career and not spoken out loudly about a lot of issues like that. And again, yeah, the comparison to Steve Kerr, who very much has been. So I found a lot of that to be like, Michael Jordan to me was just this enigma among so many people going into this, that just the idea of him sharing his thoughts for the first time, right down until the end of this, where he talks about the the destruction of the team at the end. Yep. And this guy, I wanted to go for number 7. I mean, that was pretty impactful, just that this was a guy that was not curbing his words or giving an out to Jerry Reinsdorf. He was pretty much putting this guy in front of the fire of, hey, blame this guy, because I was down to do a 7th championship. So it's much more I think anyone going into this with that hope and desire to see Jordan, who had been, you know, I think, very protective of what he would say or what he would be outspoken about, you certainly got a look into who this guy was and what made him tick. And that was I think you had to do this level of piece to really get into all of that versus, you know, imagine just a one or two episode piece on this that I don't think you'd fully get the context of Michael during this time.
And I love that you bring up the final, you know, 10 minutes or so, because I was telling Marcus that was probably my favorite part of episode 10, where we just kind of get the story of the destruction of this team prematurely. And, you know, taking it to your world, John, bringing it to the lexicon of pro wrestling. For most of this documentary, the top heel of the territory was Jerry Krause, RIP. But it was revealed after, you know, in a Vince McMahon-esque way that Jerry Reinsdorf really was, you know, kind of behind this thing the whole time. What did you make of kind of sort of our villains, quote unquote, with Krause, Reinsdorf, and even Scottie Pippen, I guess, to a certain extent? What did you make of how characters were kind of cast in this documentary?
Yeah, well, I think I think episode 10 was interesting on several levels for the people that had started from episode 1 and kind of gone on all of these different journeys of these characters and our opinions that have probably fluctuated among many of them, that it seemed that there was a definite redemption of Scottie Pippen by the end of this series. Like, this episode 10 seemed to be the ultimate make good for Scottie Pippen, because I mean, he had probably seen the biggest roller coaster of fan opinions that they leave it that, okay, here's a guy that there's kind of a mixed bag about the contract issue, and goddamn, that summer of 97 that Pippen had to enjoy, like, we were mixed on. Then it's he quits on his team and there is no public sympathy for this dude. And then here it's like this guy literally breaks down and guts his way out to finish game 6, that I think by the end it's a push and a acknowledgement of how great a player this was. Jerry Krause, I think as well, you see him that he was in the role of the messenger. I mean, he was the guy that had to carry out the orders that I don't think got enough credit for assembling this incredible team, but was the one that receives all of the blame throughout the early part of this series for not being one of the guys and being the one that's pulling this thing apart, when by the end it's, you know, it's largely left at the feet of Jerry Reinsdorf. And that's ultimately where the buck stops, and the bucks definitely stop because they were not going to be spending any more to retain all of these players. And you just see this Bulls team completely disintegrate. And I guess history can argue whether people wanted to see the Bulls go one more season longer, which would have been the strike shortened season. And did people want to have that lasting memory of a Bulls team aging and not being able to defend their title, or in the way it was taken apart, that this team goes down in history as like this legendary team that was never beaten at the end for their title? I guess you can argue both ways, but for the Chicago fan, I'm sure they wanted the answer to that question in 99.
I mean, it took until the final minutes of episode 10 for Scottie to finally acknowledge that Jerry Krause was the greatest GM in NBA history. It took that long for him to finally say a nice thing about Jerry Krause, which I thought was funny. And to the point about the revisionist history that Jordan has about coming back for her 7th title, you know, it would have required Jordan taking a pay cut. And Jordan, who was historically underpaid, just like Scottie was, those last two seasons, he got his. And I can't imagine Jordan going from making $30 million back down to even $15 million just to win the 7th title, let alone Scottie, who at that point, you know, was fed up with his contract situation too. So
yeah, to me,
I don't
it was,
buy that.
I think it was untenable that they could have kept them together. I mean, with what like Rodman was done at this point.
Yep.
I mean, it was. I think mentally, like Phil Jackson seemed like he was mentally done by this point. It seemed like he went into this season with the acknowledgement, this is the end, and that was going to be it. To me, there were just way too many factors that it's simplistic as Jerry Reinsdorf just snapping his fingers to keep this team together. But I mean, at the same time, you look at this was, you know, one of the greatest franchises in history, and it just fell apart. But I mean, that is that is pro sports. Like the idea of getting a team like that, it's, you know, locally, like we saw that with the Toronto Blue Jays of a few years ago. It's like, if you can catch lightning in a bottle and get it for two seasons, that's yeah. great. And then this yeah. is over. It's you're not getting to get six championships in a decade is remarkable. And I don't know how often we're going to see that in the marketplace where, I mean, a Scottie Pippen would never be playing for that amount of time at that little of a contract.
No, Scottie would have been a max player.
Yeah.
But John, like, as somebody who, you know, maybe had a passing familiarity with some of these characters in the documentary, was there somebody you wish you would have heard more from? Because I know, you know, Marcus and I have talked. For me, my list would be, like, I needed more from Phil Jackson. I needed more from Tony Kukoc, because I think, like, his whole backstory coming from a war-torn country, that doesn't get a lot of play in this documentary. And then there's the specter of Juanita Jordan. I was like, is she not going to be in this thing? But for you, John, is there anybody that you wanted to hear more from, or somebody who wasn't in the documentary, or maybe LeBron that you wanted to hear from?
LeBron would have been a great voice to have in there. I definitely agree that Tony Kukoc seemed to be the one that was most overlooked, and you almost, given the way they kind of introduced him, that he was like almost that he was Jerry Krause's guy, that Jordan and Pippen pretty much treated like I guess Michael Cole and JBL did when Sting came in for WrestleMania that year. a minnow in a giant ocean. Kukoc like comes off as like almost like that he was a cog in the wheel that was not in any way life or death to our success. I mean, that's kind of how he's portrayed in this. I was fascinated, as I was telling you the other day, Nate, by Slim Buehler. I think yes. I think we could get a whole 30 for 30 on this guy. Just go down that rabbit hole, the Chronicles of Slim Buehler. Yeah, with Juanita Jordan, I get the sense that they were not looking at opening that can of worms up at all. So, I mean, she does not even exist in this world. And I can't say it's a worse documentary for it. It's whether you're looking at this as the story of the Chicago Bulls versus the story of Michael Jordan. If it's the latter, then that's a pretty significant omission. Yeah. But, I mean, you pick and choose as well, right? Like that is what this documentary can say, that we weren't doing the Jordan story and therefore don't go that route. But then again, there's plenty of off-court involvement of people attached to Michael Jordan that is very much part of this. Like this, it is kind of one in the same, that this is a Michael Jordan documentary as much as it is a Chicago Bulls documentary. But I mean, I will not complain that wasn't like, would we have wanted 20 minutes dedicated to that? Does that make this stronger? It definitely goes off the path from being the kind of Chicago Bulls chronology that they were obviously shooting for.
I wanted to hear from Byron Russell.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God.
I guess Jason Aaron did reach out to, and he did decline along with Karl Malone. But
Karl Malone,
I think Russell
declined. Huh.
Yeah, he declined. Yeah.
Russell is Scott Burrell, man. I mean, just takes it
what
right
a nice guy.
Hey, try not to be dog shit tonight.
Man,
I thought Blue Jay Zone, right in the end, though, Reggie Miller, I thought was pretty great in episode 9.
Yeah,
I mean, this
Reggie
is like the
great.
Most. It's like a humble Reggie Miller, but he's still Reggie Miller. I mean, this was a guy who, I mean, he had his target on the King, and he was coming right for him in that series. And I think realized I'm here in a Jordan documentary. I'm going to be deferential to the guy, but this was someone that, I mean, I think you were either. You either loved Reggie Miller or you hated Reggie Miller. I always rooted against him, but that's just because he was – no matter what game you were watching, and I would always root for the Knicks against this guy, and time after time, this guy – I could never get so invested in any kind of lead because I always knew there was that final 60 seconds, and Reggie Miller was the player I hated to have to root against in that final 60 seconds because I knew what this guy was going to be capable of. So I always had a begrudging respect for Reggie Miller.
I think the same way that younger people were introduced to Jordan in this documentary, they were also introduced to Reggie Miller, the basketball player, because he's now known as Reggie Miller, the broadcaster, who is not that great. But during his prime in Indiana, I mean, he was a he was not the best two guard, but if there is a game on the line, he was the guy you would want having the ball and taking that shot. Yeah. I mean, he was just a killer.
Just before we move on from Jordan, one of Jordan's many targets in this, is there anything that was more of a just dagger than as they're getting ready for game 7 with the Pacers, Jordan just in Jordan mode getting ready, and Ahmad Rashad saying, some can, some can't, and Jordan's response, don't say that around Scott Burrell. You're going to scare the shit out of Scott Burrell. Like, this is a man that is not capable of this level of stage and this pressure on his shoulders. The man will crumble. Here's that. I mean, Christ, dude. If just the daggers that come out for poor Scott Burrell by the end of this. Maybe the most sympathetic figure by the end of this.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I think we learned two things from this documentary. Number one, you know, we had our beliefs confirmed that Michael Jordan is the greatest basketball player to ever walk the face of the earth. Number two, Mike might be the pettiest person that has ever lived. And this brings us back to Marcus and I were talking before you came on, John, about the story in episode 9 about the flu game with the pizza that he got from Salt Lake City.
Mm-hmm.
And the detail that stuck out to me is kind of odd is, you know, Mike's got his little entourage, he's got his crew, and they get this large pizza, and Mike's the only person that eats the pizza and gets sick. And I'm like, that doesn't add up. That doesn't make sense. The whole night, I'm thinking that doesn't make sense. Then I listened to the Jalen Rose and David Jacoby podcast with Jason Ayer, mm-hmm. where he kind of gives behind the scenes insight and stuff that didn't make it into the documentary. And apparently, Tim Grover, Michael's strength and fitness coach, was there, you know, with that crew. And he's like, the reason Michael was the only person that ate the pizza is because this was late at night. And the rest of the guys had already gotten dinner 2 or 3 hours ahead of time, you know, because it was getting late. And so when they get back to the hotel room, it's like 10, 11 o'clock at night. Mike is like, I'm hungry. Nothing's open in Salt Lake City. So they order the pizza. The pizza gets there, and everybody's getting ready to, you know, grab a slice. Because, you know, you got a large group and a, you know, large pizza. Everybody grabs a slice. Michael Jordan, John Pollock, spits on the pizza, looks at his crew and says, that's for none of y'all MFers waiting for me to eat. And so that's the reason Mike was the only person to eat the pizza, is because he spit on the pizza so nobody else could get a slice.
I heard this story, and for the life of me, cannot, with the exception of if that story came after interview number 3 with Jordan, how is that not asked of Michael Jordan, if for nothing else than for him to just give that Jordan grin,
yes,
of, I don't recall. Because what makes that story so plausible is these 10 episodes where we have seen Michael Jordan, and right down to, I mean, being at a restaurant with Coach Carl of the Supersonics, not giving him the proper greeting that he felt Michael Jordan was entitled to during this series. And I took that personally. Like, this was a guy that would just find anything, the sliver of an infraction that he would exploit to just, almost like he just needed the slightest tap to open the floodgates of what he knew he had in him to just destroy an individual, destroy a team, and that is how he channeled what he could. And there's a certain level of awe that this man can channel it, but also one of just an incredible level of pettiness that he displays to be able to conjure that. Like, winning was not enough. The drive for a championship wasn't enough. It was leaving a personal stain on somebody's legacy that pushed this guy to to go to unbelievable lengths. And then, even when battle is won, getting like that final jab in like he does to Larry Bird,
yep,
of, now you can work on that golf game of yours. Like, here's some, imagine the tables turned and Michael Jordan has just lost that game, and it's Larry Bird telling Michael, good luck on that golf game of yours this summer that you can get a head start on while we move on to the finals. I mean, that would eat that man alive. Michael Jordan isn't walking away from the game that summer if that comment is left in him from a Larry Bird, if it's the other way around. And he knows this. He lives this, and he still gets that jab in on Larry Bird. And I just found this guy to be what an insight into who this guy was.
He even dropped a bitch in there too. He was ahead of the time for WWE. He got his bitch reference off in there to Bird.
Oh man, I was ready for Larry Bird to just slap this guy after that comment, but no, Larry Bird was just Larry Bird had some fun moments in this thing, like between the All-Star game and just rallying everybody. He's like, well, we might as well win. To the reaction when Reggie Miller hits the three-pointer, and they cut to Larry Bird that could not possibly be bothered and is not getting his hopes up at all that this is the end. Larry Bird had a few nice cameos.
Yes.
Another cameo that wrestling fans were keen on and damn near destroyed Twitter on Sunday night, John, was when we saw Dennis Rodman leave in the middle of the finals to hang out with your man Terry Bollea.
Yeah, that's right. I didn't know if they would actually go into this or not. I didn't know if it was, you know, it was something that got like a fair amount of attention at the time, that here Rodman skips practice and then he shows up on Nitro. I mean, it was a hell of a coup for WCW just to be able to get that kind of like, really, when you look at the final years of WCW, that 1 month where they get that moment, and then they end up getting, like, everyone knew, like, Rodman was in to do, like, his match. But to get Karl Malone as well, coming off that series that is watched by a million people that watch Game 6, and then several weeks later, you get the two of them in a wrestling ring. Like, that, to me, was one of Eric Bischoff's finest promotional coups of his career. And yeah, it was something that, you know, they spent like the requisite time on, and it's, yeah, I mean, you guys can probably attest to the fact of like the attention it received at the time. Like I just recall it being something that it was such an easy story for any sports outlet to jump on, that here's Dennis Rodman blowing off practice and showing up at a wrestling show.
Yes, and I was pleasantly surprised that they did not feature Hogan, a sit down with Hogan, even if it was just for 30 seconds, just talking about Rodman. But yeah, I mean, that was a huge one of those stories that, you know, it crossed outside the wrestling world and crossed into mainstream culture. It was, you know, Rodman skipping out on practice. And I was telling Nate earlier, could you imagine if that happened in 2020 with a player skipping practice to do today's wrestling product? Where I think wrestling is not on the same popularity level as it was in the late 90s, I think it would be a whole different reaction to that, you know, to that move.
Well, I mean, the closest we'd get would be, I mean, granted, he was like retired at the time, but like Rob Gronkowski coming in, I mean, it's under these weird circumstances of these empty arena shows, but to me was like nothing in comparison. I mean, it got its like some level of attention, but I would say like a blip on the radar in terms of, you know, crossovers of what they would assume a Rob Gronkowski coming in to do a WrestleMania would have generated in terms of a kind of buzz for the company.
So what you're saying is you want to see Kawhi Leonard show up on 205 Live?
Yeah, I would love to see Kawhi show up. I don't know if he would be the best promo of anyone out there.
It's better than Ricochet.
maybe Horace Grant could come in as the GM or something on 205.
So you mentioned Horace Grant.
We got to talk about this. What would you call it?
Follow up. I'm curious about this.
So this is Horace's last dance. He went on the radio Tuesday and essentially called Jordan a liar. And on top of that, basically challenged him to, like, you know, let's talk this out, or we can settle it another way. This doesn't seem like the smart move on Horace's part. Whether Jordan is telling the truth or not, it just feels like you know, you don't want to do out the king, and especially in a public like this. Not that I expect Jordan to jump on the radio this week and respond to Horace, but just knowing and just watching what kind of person and personality Jordan is, I wouldn't want to, you know, I would want those issues in my personal or professional life dealing with this man.
What was his biggest gripe? Was it like the Sam Smith connection?
The Sam Smith connection. Yeah.
Which is something that ultimately Jordan can't prove. He can assume it. But I mean, we even had like other people in the documentary that were stating like Sam Smith was talking to lots of people, and to just like source guess, it's kind of reckless on Jordan's part to just, you know, make that declaration, and you can't prove it. He can have his assumptions, but that's what they are.
Yeah.
Have either of you read that book?
I read it as a kid. I have not read it since elementary school.
Yeah, it's been a while. But like that book was huge. Like back when books could be huge.
Yeah.
Like that, for especially for sports fans, like you got the most famous athlete on the planet, and this is like the tell all, the expose. And yeah, like for somebody that was a sports fan, somebody that was trying to, you know, figure out what I wanted to do when I grew up, and then, you know, do I want to be a journalist like Marcus, or do I want to be a gas bag like Skip Bayless and just talk? and obviously I chose the path of least resistance, but yeah, like that was a big book. And so I was glad that they brought that up in the documentary, and that they were able to get Sam on.
Yeah. In terms of like the people that were around Jordan in that kind of a capacity, that's where I was a bit disappointed that we didn't get more out of Ahmad Rashad, who was just that was Jordan's go-to. And I mean, what that guy must have seen, I think he did it with the understanding that what I see is for my eyes only. And I think that guy would probably have about as open access as possible in terms of a media member around Michael Jordan. And I mean, he had his anecdotes, he had his stories throughout this, but I just feel like that guy, if he ever wanted to, would have quite the compelling tale about the Michael Jordan years, because I'm sure he was privy to a lot that no other media member was getting access to.
Yeah, but the thing is with that, John, I agree, but Michael Jordan also had final cut on this deal. And according to Jason Ayer, like, Michael wasn't super hands-on. There were a couple of times he reached out to him and was like, you know, I got a question about this, or you need to add this or remove this. But I think if Mike wanted to, knowing the kind of person he is through this documentary, like, yeah, the fact that we got this at all is kind of amazing.
Yeah, and I think that's where I think most people are going to come down on. I mean, to me, going like, you know, the Ken Burns debate about, you know, yeah, like that's absolutely a criticism you can levy at this. But did this 30 for 30 ever present itself as anything other than what it was? That the alternative is this doesn't happen. This doesn't see the light of day. So, and I guess I'd just say, like, yes, Jordan had like an editorial control of this, which would not be, you know, that's not journalism by definition. At the same sense, this is what areas would you change to make this a better documentary? There's probably areas that you could have gone into more or that you could have introduced, but judging it by the end product, where are the blind spots that they focused on? Like, there was, you know, Jordan's ex-wife. There is, you know, certain people that maybe you would have wanted to hear from that they couldn't. But in terms of the totality of it, I mean, I was pretty blown away by these 10 episodes. And I think that you can have like a completely like meaningful conversation on like the good and bad of, you know, what goes into this, and whether that's a sign of where documentaries are in this day and age, that to have these kinds of figures involved, that's somewhat of the trade-off. And any director is going to, I guess, have to make that kind of a choice of it's either Jordan's on board in this capacity or he's not on board at all, because it's not like this is a vehicle that could have seen the light of day if Jordan's not involved.
I think it's entertainment. People, I understand both sides of, you know, criticizing some of the omissions, but at the end of the day, this is more entertainment than I think a true quote unquote documentary. And obviously, Jerry Krause being dead, Jerry Krause can't give his response. Juanita Jordan getting a huge settlement was not going to be mentioned in this documentary for obvious reasons. I do think that some of the Jordan stories, maybe you go back to more teammates and try to sort of verify and get more of their rebuttal. I mean, there was a decent amount of rebuttal from teammates on certain stuff.
You also have to remember that, like, this wasn't finished and it got pushed up, because I think Air said that he, you know, was planning to go down and talk to Scottie Pippen again in March and some other things like that. But because of the coronavirus, everything got fast forwarded. And so maybe some of the stuff that you're talking about, Marcus, might have been included had he been given, you know, the full amount of time for this.
Yeah, and, you know, I wonder how much different it would have been those last two episodes if he had the time. I wouldn't say those two felt rushed, but I just felt like the last two weren't on the same level as the first eight. And maybe because we knew what the ending was already.
Yeah, like, I feel the only thing that you could look, and this was probably, I mean, they probably had a good idea of what the 10 episodes were going to be pre-pandemic, but to see something where, in all of these episodes, all of these key players, I mean, the overlying theme is like they're all united by this team that they were all part of, and yet they're always separate. There was no like big culmination where they get together, or there's some kind of, like, we've seen them all in these separate locations throughout nine episodes to do something in the 10th where there's some kind of reunion with like the starting five or something like that, or with Phil Jackson. But I mean, that's, you know, that's just, you know, a different option that they could have gone with. But in this climate, you're not getting people together and traveling to do anything like that. But I'm certain if there's any chance of doing something like that, I don't think ESPN could say yes quick enough to do something beyond this. I mean, they would pump out whatever they could. I mean, this has been their most successful documentary in history.
Yep. Well, John, the 98 Bulls might not have had a chance to get back together at the end of this documentary, but I'm glad that we had a chance to reunite this week on the Kings of Sport. Before we let you go, before we wrap up the show this week, can you let the good people know what you got going on at Post Wrestling? Obviously, even in the midst of a pandemic, wrestling news never stops, particularly this week with some unfortunate news. But what have you got going on, you and Way, over at Post Wrestling?
Well, we will be going live on Saturday night right after the Double or Nothing show that AEW is putting on in Jacksonville. So if you want to check that out, the show will be up at postwrestling.com. If you want to tune in live, that's available for our Double Ice Cap and Espresso patrons up at postwrestlingcafe.com. And then we've got all our regular shows that are dropping over the next few days. We have Rewind to Dynamite Wednesday night, Rewind to SmackDown on Friday, where we will also discuss the season finale of Dark Side of the Ring, that focused on Owen Hart, that aired on Tuesday.
Marcus Vandenberg, where can the people find you? Where can they hit you up on social media, get your insight on the world of sports or anything else going on out there, or fatherhood tips, you and John being the proud papas around these parts. Where can people hit you up?
You can find me on social media at Marco Will, MarcoWill. And real quick, let's have a fun game. Guess Ahmad Rashad's age.
Ahmad Rashad's age. Okay. I think that guy is certainly much older than he looks. So I am going to go, all the way and say 61.
Ooh.
All right, Nate.
I'll go 65.
70.
He's 70?
70.
Wow. Dude, I thought I was being like, I thought I was stretching a bit going plus 60. But, I mean, it makes sense when you think about, like, Jesus, like, how long that guy has been on your television screen for. But 70.
People forget he actually was a football player before all this.
A good football player at that, yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, let us, on the trivia note, go out remembering the first selection in the history of the Toronto Raptors, won B.J. Armstrong.
Wow.
Who quickly bolted. He didn't play a game with us. He was in Golden State before he could even say Toronto.
Well, it's his loss.
Oh, that jersey was on and off. It's like, no. Damon Stoudemire, this team is all yours. I'm out of here.
Somewhere a teenage John Pollock is crying at his B.J. Armstrong pre-ordered jersey.
Well, listen, I was so excited because I was like, oh, my God, the Raptors drafted a player I know. I've heard of this guy.
Which he's got championship DNA.
Got somebody. Instead, it was your starting lineup of Oliver Miller, Jean Tabak, and Oliver Elvin Miller. Robertson.
Alvin Robertson.
Oh man, Oliver Miller, the big O.
John Sally. We got John Sally in that first season by Brendan Malone. So there you go. Connection to the Pistons.
I think my favorite Raptor was probably Rafer Alston.
Okay. That makes you you would be the one that would probably categorize.
I was a big Rafer Alston fan. Like, he made it from the playgrounds to Toronto.
I would say by, gotta like, be by 01. We, you know, with Olajuwon, with Oakley, we had Antonio Davis at that time. I mean, that was
Muggsy Bogues,
of course.
Come on, that team was interesting.
Marcus Camby was still in the mix at that point. We had Tracy McGrady. It was like there was a lot of potential there that kind of peaked in 01, and then it was a long, long road to last season.
So, and now you got a ring, so it all worked out.
That's it. That's it. So, we are the defending NBA champions, and I predict that no one's going to top us this year. There's not anyone that's going to knock the Raptors off this season. That's my prediction.
We'll have to wait to see. If you want to find me on social media, in the number 8, M-O-Z-A-I-K, at Nate Mosaic. Don't forget about the Patreon, Patreon.com. That's where it is. / the Kings of Sport. John and Wade have a wonderful Patreon as well. So while you're supporting us, go support them. Post wrestling. You can, speaking of post wrestling, you can check out the Rocky Maivia Picture Show every month. The latest edition is out, featuring myself and Clement Bryant, who is a film and TV marketer and a podcaster. We talked about 2013 Snitch. So you can check that out right now on post wrestling. I think that's it. Yeah, Twitter in the number 8, M-O-Z-A-I-K, at Nate Mosaic. And that's going to do it for this week. We have concluded our series on The Last Dance. So I guess what this means, Marcus, and maybe John, is next week we start our series on Lance Armstrong.
Oh, goodness.
Oh, yeah. Two-part series on Lance.
I don't think that's getting, like, that's not even going to get half of the Jordan rating.
No. I've been going back because TSN up here in Canada, they've been airing, like, their Tuesday nights, they air all these old 30 for 30s. So I've just been watching so many of them. And, I mean, it's from a technical standpoint, it's a pretty awful documentary, but it's also so depressing. And that was Broke.
Oh, yeah.
It's just there's no B-roll that they have for this. So it's just each guy on camera with a green screen.
Yep.
Tell, like, outdoing each other with a worse story than the last guy about like the stupid ideas that they got pitched on for businesses, like problems with like wives that they had to pay alimony for, just every athlete that had no idea how to handle this money. And it's 90 minutes. And that's my 30 for 30 story. Maybe you guys should go back right from the beginning and go through these 30 for 30s. Because there's been some great ones. There's also been some poor
ones. There's been some bad ones, yeah.
There's been some bad ones. Some really good ones, though. Like, I enjoyed the Ric Flair one. The one with Vlade Divac and
Escobars. That's an excellent one.
Two Escobars is a good one. You know, you talk about Reggie Miller and the Knicks. They had one on that rivalry that was pretty good.
Mm-hmm. The Christian Laettner one I liked. I just watched the Pistons one.
Bad Boys? Yeah,
I liked that. I had never seen that until I found it after this series started. I love that one. That one was really great.
Oh, yeah,
another former Raptor icon, Isaiah Thomas.
Yes, Isaiah Thomas, another villain in the Last Dance documentary.
Unfair towards poor Isaiah. Dream Team 92, honorary member.
Oh, but yeah, we could be here all day talking 90s basketball, but John's got stuff to do, Marcus has stuff to do, I have stuff to do, you have stuff to do, dear listeners, so we're going to end it here. John, thank you as always for making time.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, guys. This was a lot of fun.
We will talk to you soon and give our best to Wei Ting.
I will pass it along.
All right. So, for John Pollock, for Marcus Vandenberg, for Young Simba, and of course, for Michael Jeffrey Jordan, I am the Godfather, Nate Milton. Rest easy, Scott Burrell. It's over now. 'Cause you've been down with the Kings. Well, that's all for this week's edition of the Kings of Sport. Be sure to come back next week for an all-new episode. You can leave feedback for the show on Twitter at KOS_POD or via Gmail at thekingsofsport@gmail.com. Don't forget to like and rate us on iTunes and tell a friend. The Kings of Sport is a production of the Mosaic Podcast Network.
Whether you like it or not, he's back. D-A-double-D-Y, thanks, thanks.
Let me tell you something, Mean Gene. I'm gonna go out there and I'm gonna leave it all on the mat, because that's what I do when I get it done, so I can do it. Yeah!